So yeah, thanks a lot for having me here. I came up from New Brunswick, and it's really nice. The crowds here are a bit bigger than they are in Fredericton. It's probably because your population's about six times what ours is, but yeah, I really like Halifax, and it's nice to see some familiar faces as well. Yeah, I am going to be speaking on the class-based characterization of deviancy and the criminalization of dissent. I wasn't sure what kind of audience was going to be here today, so I don't know how familiar people are going to be with the kind of concepts that I'm talking about, but even for myself, and I've got a fair history of social justice activism, even after being in law school, now thinking about these things and just deconstructing more and more exactly how the law operates with a very defined intention to achieve certain goals, it doesn't cease to disturb me any. So I'm going to try and explain, I guess, that a bit. Where we'll be starting right here is just with the looking at the theoretical basis for approaching a class-conscious critique of criminalization. I'm going to be approaching this from a very ideological framework, right? I already have my mind made up on this. I'm not just kind of considering, whether or not the law is used in a good or a bad way and things along those lines. And I'm not going to be advocating for reform of criminal law, which is what a lot of lawyers do. I'm going to be saying that change is necessary for sure, but not reform, because you don't reform something that works exactly as it should, exactly as it was designed to work. You don't reform that. It's perfectly fine. You can change it completely. You can put something else there, but you don't reform it. So I'll just briefly outline the direction that I'm going to be taking here, because it's a potentially endless area of discussion. First, we're going to identify exactly what deviancy is according to the laws that govern us, and that includes identifying who decides what it is and why. And we're also going to look at what dissent is and what kinds of dissent emerge when human conduct is labeled as deviant. And third, we'll examine why the Canadian state criminalizes deviant dissent when it becomes a threat to the stability of the hierarchical social order that exists in Canada. We're going to look at the careful art of constructing and defining notions of deviancy. Because before we look at how the Canadian state has managed to legally isolate and attack politicized groups that it feels is a threat to its interests, it's beneficial to look first at the roots of how and why our system condemns certain conduct. Black's Law Dictionary, which is used by judges and lawyers, and it's a very hallmark part of jurisprudence that develops in the courts, defines deviancy as the quality or state of departing from established norms, especially in social customs. So, but let's read this into a politicized context, right? Let's read this into our own lived reality. And when we do that, we see that deviancy is the quality or state of departing from established norms, especially social customs, that are informed by reference to the culture of the capitalist, law and order-based system of competition, exploitation, divisiveness, meritocracy, and victim-blaming that has emerged from Canada's brutally racist colonial history. Those are the norms and social customs that inform the law. And that kind of extrapolation is a bit of a mouthful from what is in Black's Law Dictionary, but the truth of it as well is undeniable. Those who have historically been amongst the lawmaking class greatly benefit from these things. And it's that same group of people, the descendants of them, which still maintain the reins of power in formal power in Canada today, because these things are maintained in law. As much as we want to convince ourselves that we make great social progress against them. So when we reflect on this definition of deviancy for a moment, it's easy to see that there's a very important classist value judgment that's involved inherently in the characterization of conduct as being deviant or not. And that in turn, that conduct which is decided, which is made deviant, ultimately becomes the subject of criminalization. Now, it's true that there are positive peripheral elements as well that inform Canada's established norms and social customs. The struggles of workers, racialized persons, the queer community, differently abled folks, First Nations, women, youth, have all made really important headway in terms of changing the law and in winning rights for some of the most disadvantaged people in Canadian society. And this headway has been, you know, as I mentioned, has been reflected in the norms and social customs that have developed. It would be, you know, just be ridiculous to say that it wasn't. And it has become part of our legal system as well. We have human rights codes and we have labor codes and so on. And likewise, some types of deviancy are undoubtedly universal. And these kind of universal deviancies are things that any society, you can have the most right-wing or the most left-wing, you can have it however you want to call it, you can have, even in a state of anarchy, it doesn't matter, you need to have some kind of activities which are universally deviant. And I'm sure you can use your imaginations to think of things that any reasonable person, for any society to function, has to prohibit. The people in the society have to agree this is bad, we shouldn't do this. And it has to be condemned. However, those are the exceptions rather than the rule. The rule that I propose is that value systems of the oppressor class inform the majority of legislation that creates deviancy, and that as a result, criminalization of deviant behavior is carried out to protect class-based interests, where such behavior would pose a threat, intentional or not, to the existing socioeconomic hierarchy that exists in Canada. When we don't approve of the ideological framework of the aforementioned oppressor class, we engage in dissent. And if we take a look back again at Black's Law Dictionary, dissent is defined as a withholding of assent or approval. Dissent in and of itself it's not anything remarkable. I mean, we can all, you know, disagree with the state, and lots of people in society, if not the majority of people in society, disagree with the state on many levels about many things. And, you know, as bad as some things are in Canada in terms of criminalization, we're not yet a 1984 or a Fahrenheit 451 society. You know, we're still allowed to think, right? We're not, our thoughts aren't criminalized, even though we might even think deviant thoughts. We're also allowed to disagree with the state, and that's not necessarily enough to bring down the wrath of the state either. Even some forms of peaceful protests are allowed in tokenistic ways for people to express themselves and let off some steam, and then are kind of just forgotten by the wayside. Where the wrath of the state, though, is brought down is at that juncture where dissent becomes deviant and criminalized as a result of the dissenter taking action to express that dissent in a manner which effectively challenges the controlling norms and social customs imposed by the state through law, thereby threatening the stability of the existing socioeconomic hierarchy. So it's when you begin effectively challenging the state, and that doesn't mean that you necessarily have to be violent in what you're doing. There's many ways that you can do that. You can do that by creating free schools. You can be doing that by reclaiming land. You can do that by, you know, standing up in defense of Africville. You can do it in many, many ways where you effectively challenge the state. That's when your actions become criminalized. That's when your dissent becomes deviant and becomes criminalized. And I'm of the opinion that at a most basic level, deviant dissent can be categorized in at least two different groups. Inherent deviant dissent and chosen deviant dissent. Inherent deviant dissent exists within communities which, as a result of historical influences and ongoing inequities and the existence of supremacist ideologies in Canada, are alienated and marginalized from the ability to significantly influence state action through legal means. The African-Canadian community, immigrants and refugees, working-class youth, the poor, non-status persons, and of course First Nations, amongst others, are all members of inherent deviant dissent communities. These groups as wholes, whether they like it or not, are forced into tension and conflict with the state. There's no choice. There's zero choice. There's no option but to dissent because of, by their very nature of these communities, their mere existence clashes with the norms and the social customs of the state. We see this around us on a daily basis, and it's ingrained at almost every level. And the examples of these things are not few. The racial profiling of black youth by police forces across this country, the highly disproportionate incarceration of black folks by the courts. If you spend any time in a courthouse or in a jail, you'll see exactly what I'm talking about. And it's absolutely shocking. It's worse than you think. The discriminatory expulsion of black youth from the school system and the mandated gentrification and destruction of strong black communities are all examples of conditions which bring about inherent deviant dissent. If we want to look at Aboriginal peoples, the residential school legacy affecting First Nations, which was made possible by the Gradual Civilization Act, which is now carried on. We're told that residential schools don't exist anymore. What does exist is child and family services, which is the new form of residential schools going into Native communities and abducting children. We have things such as the forced sterilization of Native children that was authorized by the Sexual Sterilization Acts up until the 1970s. And we have the continued forced assimilation of Native persons into colonial frameworks that is carried out by the Department of Indian Affairs. Migrant workers as well. Systematic deportations of injured migrant workers so they can't collect benefits when they're here. Canadian government's refusal to allow them to access the very employment insurance that they pay into and they can't collect from it. And policies which deny them access to permanent resident status despite decades of work experience in Canada. If you want to have permanent resident status in Canada, you've got to have money. And you have money because you can afford a post-secondary education abroad, or you can enter into the entrepreneurship class where you just buy your way in. But migrant workers who work here for decades can't get permanent resident status. If we want to look at the poor in general, when we're looking at inherent deviant dissent and how it's manifested in communities, the so-called Safe Streets Acts that exist across Canada that empower the police to target the poor within nearly all urban communities, insufficient levels of social assistance which are provided to the poor, and even decisions by the Supreme Court of Canada itself ruling that there is no constitutional right to a minimum standard of living. No, you do not have a constitutional right in Canada to food, clothing, shelter, nothing. And it's food for thought, right? You think, well, we have a good welfare system, you know, but that's not even constitutionally protected. Even if you think it's good, which it's not, it's not even constitutionally protected. The government can get rid of it tomorrow and can have any number of families out on the street. It is not illegal for the Canadian government to do that. And the Supreme Court said, nope, they can do whatever they want. You have no minimum standard of living in this country at all. So if you want to look at something that puts people at odds with the state and forces them to get into deviant dissent and then be subject to criminalization, the recipe is perfect in this country for it. And yeah, social conditions such as these at nearly every level of our so-called civil society inherently put these and other marginalized groups at odds with the norms and social customs which characterize a wealthy, Eurocentric, capitalist state and its laws. Natural resistance by these and other marginalized groups to these unnatural conditions is therein a form of deviant dissent, which is criminalized to complement the existing marginalization which spawned the conditions in the first place. This criminalization occurs because even when these communities are unorganized, people that make up the membership in them are so exploited and disadvantaged that they still pose an omnipresent threat to the state and its stability, because they foster within them a great potential for resistance and rebellion towards the state. And although each of these communities is obviously, it's extremely varied and it's extremely unique, they're not, oppressed communities are not all the same by a long stretch. They come in all shapes and sizes and in different historical realities. They all share somewhat similar histories of being at odds with the oppressor class's norms and social customs, which inform our laws. We, and the people from the communities, some of you might be from those communities yourselves here today, we do not make up the lawmaking class in Canada. It is a class of people, and they have allegiances, and it's not to us. We do not have a role in making laws in this country at all. We are completely disconnected from it. And that is why we're at odds with the norms and the social customs that make up our laws, because they come from a completely different class than ourselves. And because of this, each one of these communities that I was just discussing is a potential powder keg if it's organized properly, if the members from within it organize themselves and educate themselves. And therefore, they must be kept suppressed. And this gets down to what my primary argument is, more or less, is that the main goal behind the state's criminalization of inherent deviant descent communities is that criminalization serves to prevent members of these communities from developing themselves and their brethren from a condition of inherent descent into a revolutionary consciousness that engages in chosen descent. And so what's chosen descent? Chosen descent emerges from within, or in some cases from outside of, inherent deviant descent communities. Chosen deviant descent involves an acknowledgement of oppression against you and or others. You acknowledge this oppression that's going on. If they call back, I'm going to find out who they are. Again, the primary goal between why the state criminalizes inherent deviant descent communities that aren't necessarily organized, but because of what I was just discussing now, they are inherently at odds with the state. The reason why they're criminalized, there's many reasons, but the primary reason is that it serves to prevent members of those communities from developing themselves and their brothers and sisters from a condition of inherent deviant descent into a revolutionary consciousness that is manifested when you engage in chosen descent, because these communities are more susceptible and more ready to organize themselves and resist than anyone else. The people that are under the strongest boot, right? They're forever at the brink, and they are ready. And there's a very developed revolutionary consciousness that just hasn't been tapped. And all it takes is people within those communities to start talking to themselves and start organizing, and they can blow the lid off the system completely. And obviously, the state wants to prevent that. So, chosen deviant descent, what is it? It emerges from within, or in some cases from outside of, inherent deviant descent communities. And chosen deviant descent involves an acknowledgement of oppression either against you or against somebody else. You don't always have to act in your self-interest. You can act in solidarity with another community. It's that acknowledgement, and it's also an intentional effort to resist and challenge that oppression. It takes place when we educate, organize, and mobilize ourselves to achieve self-governance and self-determination. And it's been the subject of intense criminalization by the state. The history of this criminalization stretches as far back as Canadian colonial criminal laws existed on this land. Potlatching, for example, was a ceremony, a tradition that was practiced in some Indigenous communities here to redistribute wealth so that everyone in the community had enough. Your stature in the community was actually increased by how much you gave away, right? Not how much you necessarily maintained for yourself. The potlatch obviously clashed with the ethics and values upon which colonial Canada was formed, and in 1885 it was made illegal in Canada after it was classified by the state and its agents as, quote, a worse than useless custom, contrary to civilized values. And yes, it was very much worse than useless. It was very useful. It was in a way that was simply not useful to the state. In fact, it ran completely counter to that. And chosen deviant descent also appeared throughout Canada's labor history as well, which has been extremely militant at times, even though we don't learn about that in school, unfortunately. The Winnipeg General Strike of 1919 was organized to bring about massive pressure on the state to change labor laws and actually bring about rights for workers, of which they had very few back then. And it was definitely a revolutionary movement that was happening at the time. Only 2 years after the Russian Revolution itself. It was one of the largest uprisings in Canada's history. There was over 22,000 workers that participated in it, and it had a very crippling effect on the economy in Winnipeg and outside of it as well. And it went on for, I think, just over a month. And it was very well crafted. And it was very well organized. And it was carried out by people who were incredibly conscious. And they worked with, you know, their brothers and sisters to help other people who didn't have a critical analysis necessarily about what was going on, but knew that something wasn't right and knew that they were being maltreated. They worked with them to develop that and to develop a united vision of what they wanted to see happen. Now, instead of listening to the strikers and seeing exactly what the hell was going on that was causing this massive general strike to happen, the Canadian state sent in at the time it was called the Royal Northwest Mounted of Police, which was one of the predecessors to the RCMP, and they beat people, they shot people, and they killed two of the strikers that participated in the strike. The fallout of that was that the Canadian government created Section 98 of the Criminal Code of Canada, which said it was unlawful to belong, that it was illegal to belong to any unlawful association. Unlawful association was one which used force to bring about any governmental, industrial, or economic change within Canada. Force. It's a very broad word. It's not talking about going out and carrying clubs and pitchforks around the streets in 1919 or 1920. Force could have meant any number of things. And if you pay attention to the words governmental, industrial, or economic change, they knew exactly what the hell they were legislating right there. And it still goes on today in words that may not necessarily be that open, but it's still happening now. This section was primarily used against communists and trade unionists when it was brought in, because they were some of the, obviously, the main people that were behind the actions such as the Winnipeg General Strike. And other laws were brought in afterwards, such as the Padlock Act, which allowed the government, it was being used mostly in Quebec, to go and put a padlock and shut down any building that was being used by communists or anyone who promoted Bolshevism. That was used, you know, with broad discretion for, I believe it was well over 20 years until it was finally found unconstitutional. But the laws weren't necessarily enough for the state. The state does pass laws, but what happens when you pass laws? People don't always follow them, right? Especially when they're making people's lives even more tormented than they already are in the first place. So in the 1960s and 1970s, organizations like the Black Panther Party were organizing in Canada, something else that we don't usually hear a lot about. We just hear about it as something that's happening in the States. There's also, you know, there's a very, very strong Quebec separatist movement as well. Both of these groups were organizing. They were both primary targets of the RCMP. The RCMP, in documents that have just been disclosed till today, were behind a huge slew of just outrageous offenses to try and stem what these groups were engaging in. They burned down a building that was being used by Quebec separatists and the Black Panthers as a meeting spot. They stole and planted dynamite to frame members of Quebec separatist groups for terrorism offenses. And during the same period, informants working for the RCMP were assaulted throughout university campuses to spy on student activists. The Canadian Association of University Teachers spoke out against this. And what was the response from the RCMP and the Canadian government? They started keeping files on the teachers.
Are you spies here today?
Well, maybe. I mean, who knows? And if there are, then maybe they're having a bit of a history lesson now. But proud tradition, right? But the procedures still exist today, that the exact same things are going on. The RCMP still operates on campuses. It operates in New Brunswick right now on campuses. There's been complaints filed at the University of New Brunswick just weeks, at the most 2 months ago, against members of the RCMP that were on campus spying and harassing students. It still goes on today. It hasn't stopped. And of course, popular mass protests and street demonstrations have been targeted for criminalization as well. Those whose chosen dissent is, you know, deviantly expressed in the streets have felt the heavy hand of the law, regardless of the size of the protest. Police in Quebec City during the free trade meetings of 2001, I believe, came out in almost unprecedented force against tens of thousands of demonstrators there. This was a broad popular movement that was happening there of working people. And it just shot off thousands upon thousands of rounds of tear gas and rubber bullets at people and turned the city into a complete state of ruin. Likewise, here in Halifax, the police have been brutal in their treatment of protesters as well. You look back at 2002, I think, it was the G20 finance ministers meeting, I believe, that happened in Halifax, and they came down with a heavy hand, and they also did again in 2007 with the anti-Atlantica protests as well. Police tactics, as somebody had mentioned earlier, in many situations involve the use of agents provocateurs as well, such as they did in Montebello, Quebec, during the Security and Prosperity Summit meetings there, who are used to be planted within crowds to cause fights and chaos so that the police can up the force that they use to be able to divide and control protesters and lessen their effectiveness. Regardless of the size of the demonstration, if in the eyes of the state security apparatus it represents a form of the people effectively taking matters into their own hands, the state will use as much force as it has to shut it down. Doesn't matter if it's big or if it's small. Doesn't matter if it's in the streets as a protest or in the community buying buildings and using them as places for people to live and teaching people revolutionary education, providing free meals to people in the community. If you provide an example of doing things for yourselves and not having to rely on the state, you'll be a target, inevitably. And that brings me to the end of this, and I'll just kind of wrap things up and show you where I was trying to take this, is that this is, as twisted as some of these acts by the state sound, one of my points was that this is exactly how it's supposed to work. This isn't, like, you know, things haven't gone terribly off course, and oh God, we all need to sit down and just, if we just talk it out and explain, oh, this is going really bad, it'll all get fixed. No, it's exactly how it is supposed to work. It's not an accident or a tragic coincidence or anything of the sort. It has a very, very practical purpose, and that maintains order in a class system that benefits a select few. It benefits the lawmaking class and the people that it has its allegiance to. It's exactly how it worked, and it's a very well-oiled machine to have something like this accomplished. And it's also not, just not to make a mistake about it, it's also not a conspiracy, though. This isn't, you know, Stephen Harper and a group of lackeys in like a dim-lit room like this one, all sitting around a table, you know, planning and conspiring like, okay, well, how are we going to oppress black people and workers and Aboriginal people and immigrants and refugees and the poor and women and youth? It has nothing to do with that. You know, it has to do with this being a logical operational model, albeit a very violent and oppressive one that has just developed. It's been a natural form of development under capitalism over decades and decades and decades. It's a compilation of conditions. It's not just one big conspiracy. This works well because it fits in perfect with capitalism and defending it. You're a very, very small group of people whose interests are being looked after. How do you do that? Well, you have to make sure that the majority are going to be disempowered and that they're going to be kept in some form of proverbial shackles. And those who are behind this, this criminal law system, are very organized. And we need to organize ourselves if we're going to have a chance in this struggle. And we need to organize ourselves in a way that we're going to fight to win. And the only way that we can do this is by developing revolutionary consciousness in our communities, working within our communities, to develop inherent dissent into chosen dissent, so that we can stop being on the defensive all the time and start going on the offensive, which is what is really needed. And although both inherent and chosen dissent are the subjects of criminalization, they both are, as I discussed, our victories have always been when we are engaging in chosen dissent. It's not when it's inherent. It's not when we are just being the ones that are being pushed around by the state and its policies. It's when we organize ourselves and we fight back. And as I mentioned, when we do go on the offensive, so that when we are together and we are engaging in chosen dissent, we have a very healthy degree of unity that we can use to defeat the state's efforts to divide and conquer our communities.